That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi there, and welcome to Grief is My Superpower. I'm Mark Lemon, award-winning children's author, bereavement ambassador, and your host for this podcast. Each week, I'll be interviewing incredible people that get open and honest about their own experience with grief. When I was 12 years old, my dad was murdered, and my life changed forever. I try to explore with my guests if it's possible to live a happy and fulfilled life after the death of a loved one. You can find me as Mark Lemon Official on Instagram and at the Lemon Drop Books website. For this episode, I speak with Kate Rothschild. Kate speaks with me about the death of her daughter, Iris, and how it shaped her outlook on life. Please don't forget to subscribe and leave a comment wherever you're listening to this podcast. By doing this, it will help us to reach more people in need of support at a tough time. This podcast is in support of children's bereavement charity, Winston's Wish. Okay, so as mentioned in my introduction, today I'm speaking with someone that I've recently connected with. And I'm so pleased that I have, because I know that you're all going to get a lot out of our conversation today. And it's Kate Rothschild. How are you, Kate?
Hi, I'm okay, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. It's always great to kick off the podcast by explaining to people where we are. I'm currently on our landing, as is this, how is the way in the world at the moment? And you're currently in the cupboard somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, for the listeners, would you be able to just introduce yourself and just, you know, explain who you are and all that, please?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Kate Rothschild. I work in music. I work for a company called Rock Nation, which is a wonderful place to work. And I manage artists. And yeah, that's about it, really.
And obviously today we're here to talk about grief. And I was just wondering whether you'd be happy to sort of share your experience with grief, please. And I do know that, you know, your grief has happened to you in many ways throughout your life. But yeah, I was just wondering whether you could just share with the listeners.
Yeah, sure. So I, as you said, I have experienced loss throughout my life. So I lost my dad when I was 13. He took his own life, and then I lost my daughter on the same day, 8th of July, 20 something years later. So yeah, those are my two quite formative experiences with grief.
I know we've spoken before off mic, obviously, about dates and how they can pop up so strangely throughout our lives. And would you be happy to maybe go into a bit more detail about what happened to your daughter, Iris?
She was 15 and a half. She was your typical, very kind of sociable, outgoing teenager. You know, she was wonderful in every way, and challenging as well, and quite headstrong and brave. And she came, the circumstances around her death were just she came to, she went to the countryside to Somerset to stay for the weekend to see her dad. And she was driving on a vehicle, like a farm vehicle, not a quad bike. It's like a farm vehicle that, you know, they've been around sort of all their lives. And she was with a friend and she was going to see her other friend who lives in the farm next door. She was just driving along a field to go and meet her off her school bus. And somehow she managed to turn the vehicle over. This extraordinary, it's an incredibly heavy vehicle that you would have thought would be impossible to turn over, but somehow she managed to turn it over and she got stuck underneath and she lost her life. And it was a huge shock to, I mean, it was just so kind of completely out of the blue. She just started the summer holidays. She was so excited. She'd been volunteering at this great organization called City Harvest, where you kind of where they collect food from restaurants and shops that they don't need, and they take them around to people who need it. And she was just full of life and so excited for the future and everything. And then she was just gone. And that was, that's how it happened.
Can you remember where you were, what you were doing, you know, at the time that you found out?
No, it's all completely crystal clear to me. I mean, so I was also in Somerset in a house nearby. She was going to stay with her dad, but I have a small house nearby. And I was, I had been in London with her, and then I had come to Somerset, and I was actually going back to London again that day. So I popped over to see her that morning, and I made her and I went to wake her up with her friend, it was quite a strange morning in a way, because first of all, it was the anniversary of my father's death, so it was kind of like I was in just, you know, you kind of, it just kind of puts you in a certain sort of slightly down frame of mind, you know, probably almost even subconsciously. So I was feeling a little, no, I wasn't feeling my most kind of jolly. But anyway, I went over to see her and woke her up around 11 a.m. And she told me that she had seen a ghost the night before. And she was like, "Mom, I saw a ghost last night. It was like a girl my age. She was sitting on my bed, like just looking at me." And she was complete, and she'd never said this to me before, but she was completely, completely convinced. And then she also said, "I have this really bad pain in my chest." And I sort of said to her, like you do to a teenager, "Oh, it's probably because you've been vaping or whatever." And so then I, you know, and we just sort of like chatted away, and I made her a cup of tea, and I made her friend. I remember I made her a friend a hot lemon because she didn't like tea. And then we just sort of hung out for a bit. And then I was going back to London for the day and for the night, just because I had some things I needed to do there. And then I was coming back again the next day. And funnily enough, as I was leaving, I thought to myself, "Oh, just stay a little bit longer and hang out." And so I actually left, and then I came back again just because I don't know, something inside me just wanted to sort of have another, you know, another sort of hour with her or something. So I came back, and but she just kind of like, you know, she was a teenager, she wanted to hang out with her friend, she wasn't really that fast, I was being a little bit annoying and needy, so we just kind of hung out a little bit longer, and then I left again. And then I arrived in London, and I got a call that said from someone who was at the house, just saying there's been an accident. And I remember initially, obviously, I just thought it was just, you know, it's a minor accident. I didn't really know what the situation was, but I kept on asking, like, "Is she breathing? Is she breathing?" And I couldn't answer. And then various other people called me, and I obviously got straight back in my car and was driving back to the country. And yeah, they told me that a helicopter was there and that there were men working on her and stuff. And then I knew that it was really serious, and no one would really answer me about because I guess they didn't really know if she was breathing or not because she was being worked on by an ambulance. And then they stopped answering the phone, I remember. And then I just kind of knew. I knew that. And I think I felt it. I think you just do. You feel that you're so connected to your child. I just felt that the connection was broken. And I just knew that she had died. And then when I got to Somerset, longest drive of my life, obviously, when I got there, she had passed away. And so the lead up to it happening was very clear. But then I think when I realized what had happened, that then it becomes a sort of out of body experience. And I, weirdly looking back, it's almost as if I'm watching myself from above. Like, it's so strange. It's so hard to describe, but I'm like looking down on the crown of my own head, just in a complete state of shock and horror. But it's really like an out of body experience. I don't know. It might be some kind of biological mechanism to protect you from the like extreme shock of it, but it was definitely like nothing I've ever experienced before.
Yeah, I can remember myself, you know, when my mum told me, and how the room was just filled with its darkness and black. And I remember that feeling like you described, of sort of an out of body experience. It's just crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, really bizarre. Yeah. Like I said, I sometimes feel like maybe it's a way of kind of protecting yourself from the extreme shock of it. Like, I almost feel like we'd just drop down dead if it wasn't for that.
Following Iris's death, and you know, I always say that, you know, when someone special dies, you know, a part of you dies with them, and I think that kind of also resonates in terms of what you said about the connection. You know, you felt that connection had been broken. How do you think your grief has made you the person that you are today?
I think that grief has changed me in many ways, some good and some not so good. I think it's made me stronger. I think it's kind of, they sort of call it scar tissue. They say it's stronger, don't they? It's almost as if the worst that could possibly happen has happened. So now I'm kind of almost bulletproof. It sort of puts everything into perspective. Little things that used to upset me don't anymore. Just nothing matters as much. But of course, it's also taken something from me. You know, I've lost a connection to a sort of twin universe, which was really a huge part of my existence, the main part of my existence. And, you know, Iris was my only daughter. I had her when I was practically a teenager. We grew up together, and no one will ever understand me the way she did. And I doubt I'll ever be able to navigate the inner world of another human being the way I could her. And, you know, that's just sort of a multiverse of understanding and shared jokes and fears and experiences that I'm alone with now. And our relationship was very close, but also very private, because I was a single mother for much of her life. So there's really no one out there who kind of gets it, or get sort of, you know, now that she's gone, it's just me who knows what's been lost. So I'm here and living, but you know, there's a huge hole inside me and all around me in my life.
That's a really interesting point, actually, because, you know, like you just said, when someone dies, we're left with all those thoughts or those memories or those feelings. And how do you navigate those, you know, on a daily basis in terms of yourself internally? You know, do you find journaling useful? Is it about listening to music? You know, what do you find useful?
In the early days, I found writing things down really useful. I don't do that so much anymore. The thing I find most useful is kind of going outside and walking in nature. I find nature to be really the most kind of calming and sort of cathartic thing. Getting outside and walking my dogs is really, really important to me.
So I want to talk about sort of the way that you've honoured Iris's legacy in terms of, you know, there's the shrine, isn't there? Which I think is hugely powerful and equally amazing. And I'm just wondering whether you could share with the listeners about, you know, how that came about and sort of creating the mind to her.
Yeah, so it's not, it's unfortunately it's not really there anymore, because so essentially what happened was when Iris died, there was such a kind of outpouring of shock and grief from, because she had loads of friends, like, you know, she was like your typical teenager. She had, you know, her friends were her life, and they created this extraordinary sort of shrine at this tree near our house with just like amazing flowers and like candles and lights and letters and signs and books and photographs and things they had of hers. And it was just an extraordinary thing, which sort of went up spontaneously in their need for somewhere to go and sort of be together. And so this tree became like a focal point for us all. Like, it became a place to celebrate her and be together in our grief. And it really took on a life of its own. So over the first year, it would be decorated once a month on the 8th. And we would all, I mean, it was like the first month or so, people were there constantly. The first few months, people were there constantly. But then it became on the 8th, we would decorate it in the most kind of, the biggest way we possibly could. So one time we covered it in millions of rainbows, a rainbow colored ribbon, sorry. And another, it was like hundreds of balloons. And another was a fairy wonderland. And each season we would create like a new installation, like a Halloween theme or Christmas. And it was a way of saying we remember and we will never let anyone forget. And it was like a monument to her for everyone to see and feel her. And I think it was really, really helpful for all of us. It was just, I don't know, it was just a way of, you know, some coming together. And it also felt like we could do something for her. You know, as a mother, you spend your life cleaning up after your children or running around after them. And then suddenly there's nothing you can do for them. And you feel so helpless. And this felt like I could do something at least. And also for her friends too, who were so important to her. One thing I knew for sure is that I needed to create a space for her friends. You know, they all used to basically live at our house. And she was very much the center of her friend group. And she would have wanted me to look out for them as they were all so sort of devastated. And so this gave us all a way of feeling connected and supported. And yeah, so that was incredibly important. The tree was really the kind of central focal point for all of us. And then following on from the first year, sort of because the council got really fed up and was like sick of us decorating things out in like public spaces, so then what we do is we create like flower wreaths and light candles on the 8th every month, and also we put up a bench opposite her tree, which we also decorate, which also annoys the council.
That's an incredible way of, you know, honouring her legacy. And also, like you say, bringing in her friends and including her friends and also the family, you know. And I think that my next question was sort of how you've supported your sons through their grief. But, you know, I think that's a really lovely way of sort of including everybody, isn't it?
Yeah, I think they found it really helpful. I mean, it's so hard with teenage boys, like, they just don't want to talk about it really. And they don't want to see you cry and they want to avoid uncomfortable conversations. And it's really difficult to get the balance right. Cause you know, they are incredibly sensitive, but they also struggle with expressing it. And so I found that the practical task of kind of creating that every month all together. And I think they found that really helpful because, you know, we'd all have to go out there and clear up the debris from the last decoration and collect flowers and leaves and branches to kind of make a wreath and light the candles. And then, you know, and then coming together, I just think grief is actually a very communal experience. And a lot of us, I think almost like I probably naturally would have gone through it very privately because I'm very private about it. I find it very difficult to cry in front of people. I find it really hard to talk about this. It's the first time I've ever really spoken to anyone outside of my very immediate family. So I probably, you know, but it was because of her friends and this kind of that we really ended up kind of coming together. And I think, you know, it really does need to be a communal thing. I think it really helps. And so the boys found that really helpful. And it was kind of more structured. It was somewhere to direct their sadness and their pain towards creating these things for her each month. And then, because also when my dad died, like, we never spoke about it again, really. I don't know whether, you know, what, how your family dealt with it, but I never even knew the day he died until I was an adult. Like, I think it was just the way things were done back then. So it was really important to me to create at least a day a month where the boys sort of had to, you know, could kind of have a bit of an outpouring and a bit of a focal point, and then they could kind of get back to living their life and being kids, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think back in, well, 1992, when my dad died, it's sort of that, there was still that sort of stiff upper lip. Let's, you know, if we talk about it, we're going to upset him. We're going to, and then that kind of, if I'm honest, that probably pushed me to where maybe your sons have been, not where they are, but, you know, in terms of sort of being a bit moody, not wanting to talk about it, because you're mirroring around other people around you, aren't you? And sort of, in terms of, if they're not talking about it, I won't talk about it. And
yeah, you don't want to make people feel uncomfortable, and you don't want to bring up difficult things. Yeah.
I mean, especially in the circumstances that both our dads died, you know, it's like, you don't, it's not a dinner party chat, is it?
Yeah, that's the thing. I think that really doesn't help, having kind of just sort of other stuff attached to it that's sort of quite scary in a way.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. So, can you share three things that make you smile when you think of Iris?
So thinking about her laugh and her sense of humor and some of her one, I mean, like, she was so funny, and some of her, and she was incredibly cut, like, bright, but also quite cutting. So she would have some really funny one-liners about people, like, I don't know, like the way I was dressed or something. And it was incredibly rude, but incredibly funny. And so she, whenever I think of like funny comments like that, that makes me laugh. Thinking about sitting her in her room with her talking about life for hours on end, even when I was absolutely desperate to go to bed, that always makes me smile. And like how she would trash my room, my bathroom. Like, I would literally come home and find like lids off everything, towels in the bath, my clothes everywhere, like a tornado had gone through the room. And I never really minded, but that always makes me smile when I think back about it.
Okay, we're going to move on to the questions from the children at Children's Bereavement Charity, Winston's Wish. And the first one is, how do you make yourself feel happy when you're feeling sad?
So like I said, I think the thing that makes me feel the happiest is going for walks outside in nature. I find the fresh air and the constancy and the kind of indifference of nature is very comforting. Like, so many lives have been lived and lost in the lifetime of a single old tree or a river or the ocean. And it just makes me feel like we're not so important. Our losses are not so significant. It just makes me feel a bit better somehow. I don't know why. It's just, I find it very healing. And then, you know, other than that, it's like hugging my boyfriend, you know, people who I love, who are a comfort to me. He's a huge comfort to me, just being sort of close to someone that you love, not necessarily talking, but just being close. I find that incredibly healing and helpful. And then having a laugh with my boys, really.
Okay, next one is, what piece of music reminds you of Iris?
Well, all music reminds me of Iris. And for like a year, I couldn't listen to any music because it just pulls something out of you. But specific songs would be Brazil by Declan McKenna, who she loved and who she actually got to meet one time, because I had an artist playing at a festival and she came along and she got to meet him. So I'm really happy about that. And Hello by Adele, because we used to sing it at the top of our lungs in the car like maniacs. And also probably Jose Gonzalez, Heartbeats, because she loved that song and we played it at her funeral. And it's just it's very much Iris, that song.
Music is so powerful, isn't it, in terms of taking you back to a particular memory. Okay, the next one is, what do you do to remember Iris on the important days across the year?
So we are gathered together with her friends. Like I said, we decorate. Ben, Iris's father, created this extraordinary kind of stone circle for her. So we were in the place where she died. So we meet there sometimes, and we bring flowers, and we talk about her, and we remember her, and just, I don't know, we celebrate her really on her birthday and on the anniversary, the year anniversary. Yeah, that's what. And also, I mean, my Instagram has become like a shrine to Iris. Like, I don't really post about anything else now. So I try to post about her every month and on the big days.
Oh, they sound really beautiful. Okay, what three things are you most thankful for at the moment?
My boys, my sons, the people in my life, especially my boyfriend, Paul, and my sister, and my closest friends. And also actually my work. I work for the best company in the world. They've been beyond supportive. I'm very, very lucky. And I think without having work to kind of refocus on and kind of get back into, it would have made everything even more difficult. So I'm really grateful for that too.
Right, so the last one, which can be a difficult one, but if you could sit down with Iris for one last time, what do you think you might like to say to her?
The truth is, I probably would just hold on to her and refuse to let her go ever again. But, you know, I think I wouldn't say anything particularly profound. I think I'd just tell her that how much I miss her and how, you know, I love her and I'll never stop loving her.
Yeah, it's amazing. Whenever that question's asked, it's love is always the one that it comes to. But
yeah, I mean, what else is there to say, really?
Exactly. But Kate, I just want to say a huge thank you for sharing your story with me today. I know it's not something you've done before, so I'm really appreciative of your time. And thank you so much.